MacCast, Sunday, July 8th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I guess we're kind of in the thick of the summer. I'm a little bit delayed getting out this episode. Had some family in town visiting, had a lot of fun, but good to be back talking with you, getting back into the thick of things. It's getting a little bit warmer, although I probably can't complain too much. Some of you back in the Midwest and back East are feeling the heat a lot more than we are here in Southern California. But we got a lot of great Mac news, a lot of great stuff to talk about, some great feedback from you. Going to answer some of your questions and stuff like that like we do each week. But before we get into all of that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Gazelle. You know, if you want to get cash for your old iOS devices, your old Macs, even your old Android devices, I think Gazelle is one of the easiest ways to do that. It takes a lot of the hassle out of reselling your old devices. You don't have to deal with private sales, with online classifieds and auction sites. It's really, really easy. All you do is you go to the website at gazelle.com, you locate your device in their system, and then you answer a few quick questions about the specific model, the kind of condition that it's in, any of the accessories that you have that go along with it. And then right there within seconds, it gives you an offer for that product. It says, we'll pay you this much for it. If you accept the offer, they send you instructions and even pay for the shipping for you to send it in, and you're done. You put it in a box, you put the shipping, prepaid shipping on there, you send it into them. Once it's received, they do a quick evaluation, make sure everything checks out in terms of what you said it had, the accessories that came with it. If it's all good, they go ahead and they pay you. You can get paid by check, by Amazon gift card, by PayPal, and it's quick and easy. And so if you want some cash to subsidize a new purchase of a new Mac or a new iOS device, I think it's definitely something worth checking out. So all you have to do is go to gazelle.com. You can get an offer, see if it's something that fits right for you, and I think you're really gonna like it. It's a simple, easy process. I can't think of any better way to get some quick cash for your old stuff. Gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. And speaking of getting a new Mac, I know a number of people are looking at the new MacBook Pros that were just refreshed at WWDC. That Retina MacBook Pro is amazing. This week, though, we heard some rumors, a little inklings, the first signs that there might be an iMac refresh coming sometime soon. Apple Insider claims that they checked, and there's a number of third-party resellers that seem to be out of stock or have dwindling stock of the iMac, specifically the 2.7 gigahertz 27-inch iMac. Best Buy was apparently listing the units as not available with no indication of a restock date. It's actually been over a year now since the 27-inch iMac saw a refresh, so it is expected that we will see a bump, at least with the processors, maybe to the new Ivy Bridge technology. Seems very likely to happen. There have been a number of kind of side rumors that Apple may be looking at a Retina 27-inch iMac. I would find that very shocking and surprising. I don't think that technology is ready to scale up to that size of display. We're talking about massive graphics there, and I just can't see that happening, but definitely a bump on the processor, a bump on some of the technologies, GPUs, a bump up to the new USB 3 like we have in the new MacBook Pros, and probably some more options, maybe a little bit better pricing on some of the solid-state build-to-order stuff. So I think that could be happening at some point. Apple's U.S. site was still listing full availability on those 27-inch iMacs, showing them in stock with 24-hour ship times. So I think it's going to be a little bit longer before we actually see those hitting the street. There are rumors that an iMac update might not actually happen until the fall. So the third-party drawdowns that we're seeing right now might just be the start of it. Apple probably has a good stock, a good healthy stock to get them through the summer. So I would expect a little bit longer, but maybe along with the iPhone and iOS 6 and stuff that's coming in the fall, we'll see an iMac refresh. And that would be good timing moving into the holiday end of the year season. So if you're thinking about a new iMac, you might want to hold off till the end of the summer and see if Apple doesn't put out some new models in the fall. Some app developers this past week seem to have a number of issues with updating some of their applications. Some very popular applications, including GoodReader and Instapaper, reported that something in Apple's App Store system was causing them to fail on launch for some customers when they updated their software. So they pushed out new updates, people were downloading them, and then when they went to launch the application would literally just crash. Apple at first was being very silent about what was going on. GoodReader posted some good details on their blog about the issue and even offered up a viable theory as to what was happening. Their feeling was that the issue was related to maybe some changes that Apple had made in its distribution engine related to the FairPlay DRM technology and sort of how it was packaging the binaries after they were uploaded to the system, because all the developers were reporting that they had tested and thoroughly tested their updates and they weren't having any issues. It was only after it got into Apple's system that they started having problems, and it wasn't isolated to any specific application. So this seemed to be what was going on. It wasn't isolated to any kind of specific version of an update, so they could push a new update and the same issue would kind of happen for some users. The main users who seemed to be impacted were ones who were updating immediately, almost after the release went live, and they were the ones who got notified of its availability, and the users basically ended up with what seemed like a corrupt binary that wouldn't open up on their device. Deleting and re-downloading the application was fixing it for some, but not in every case. And the problem with that was that if you delete the application, you often lose your app data. So GoodReader was offering a step-by-step procedure where, using iTunes, which didn't seem to be affected, you would dock your device back up to iTunes and then restore the application and then immediately go back and restore any of your data. Now, once this information became public, I think Marco Armont of Instapaper also posted about it because his users were impacted. Apple came out pretty quickly and issued a statement saying that they were aware of the issue, that it seemed generally related to the DRM code for some apps that were being downloaded, and that they were going to very quickly try and correct it. Apple also said that the issue was only affecting a, quote, small number of users, although if you were paying attention online, it seemed to be much more widespread. I think Marco was saying it was impacting pretty much all of his users and people who were upgrading. So small amount might be relative, dependent upon who you were and which applications you were using. But that said, Apple did, within, I think, 24 hours, end up resolving the issue and issuing a statement saying that it was corrected. If you had an affected application, you could actually just re-download the application from the App Store, and that should fix it for you. And I assume that meant you could download it directly from the App Store if you were having problems. But if you were impacted by this, if you have some applications that you updated recently and they're crashing on launching, you might consider re-downloading them. If that doesn't fix it, you probably want to dock into iTunes, back up your data, and then re-download, reinstall the application there after clearing it off your device. So that was what was going on, and a little bit of a rough update for Apple this week. And unfortunately for Apple, that wasn't the only issue they had with the App Store. Kaspersky Labs reported that the first Trojan, I think, ever to make its way into the App Store surfaced this week. They put a notice on their SecureList website about a malicious app that they found in the Mac App Store. The app was called Find and Call by IT Mobile, and when it was launched, it would ask you if you wanted to find friends in a phone book. If you did, the application would upload your address book data in the background, and then it used that data to send SMS spam messages to any of the numbers that it found within your address book. The messages appeared to be messages that were promoting downloading the app, so it would essentially be cyclical because you'd send it out to all your friends, or it would send out in the background to all your friends, unbeknownst to you, these text messages if they downloaded and installed the app. it would do it to their address book as well. So for sure, not anything that you'd want to be happening. And to make matters worse, if you went to the website app after downloading the app and signing up for the service, you could log in and it would give you the option to enter additional information like your social networking account info, mail account information, and even to use PayPal and link it to your PayPal to add money to your account for the app. So you probably don't want to be messing around with that until it's sort of sorted out what's going on with this application. The company behind the application appears to be a company called LabWealth.com PTE Limited out of Singapore. When they were contacted for the report, they claimed that the issue was a bug in their system, that they were beta testing the system, and that the sending out of the promotional messages was not intentional. They also had the same application in the Google Play Store, so this was impacting not just iOS users, but also Android users. After the report surfaced, all versions of the application had been reportedly pulled off of both app stores. Obviously, if you have this application, you want to delete it immediately and not use it, although the damage may have already been done if you allowed it to upload your address book. And we know that Apple's had some issues surrounding privacy and the address book and stuff like that. And starting with iOS 6, it's going to be much more transparent about asking you when you want to upload address book data through an application to their servers. It's going to be in more upfront, pop up a message and say, are you really sure we're going to send all of your address book data to this server? And in general, unless there's a very deliberate reason for the app needing to do that, I would recommend that you don't let applications have access to your address book data. There's a lot of private information in there that you probably don't want to share, and you probably want to think twice about sharing with, regardless of the app. But I guess this one's now been posted, but it is the first Trojan, or what appears to be a Trojan, showing up in the Mac app, or in the iOS App Store. Authorities in Italy are still not happy with Apple and how they're handling AppleCare warranties in the region. Italy's AGCM Antitrust Regulatory Authority was threatening Apple this week with a 300,000 euro fine, about $377,500 US, and a possible shutdown of their operations in the region if they didn't start to do a better job informing customers of their right to a two-year warranty under EU law. Back in March, the same organization successfully fought Apple on an appeal and fined the company about 900,000 euros or 1.2 million over the same policy. At the root of the issue is the fact that the AGCM feels that Apple isn't adequately informing customers that under EU law, they get a standard two-year warranty on their new Mac purchases. Apple typically offers just a one-year warranty and then uses their AppleCare to add an additional 2 years of coverage. The AGCM is alleging that Apple isn't properly informing customers in an attempt to better sell their AppleCare extended warranties in the region. Because of this, the AGCM is claiming that Apple has failed to comply with the terms laid out in the March ruling and that they need to comply within the next 30 days or face a 30-day shutdown in Italy. For its part, Apple did issue a statement and they claim to have introduced a number of measures to address the Italian competition authorities' concerns, and they said that they disagree with the latest complaint. And they're, of course, appealing the latest complaint as well. So we'll have to see what happens. Hopefully they won't shut down operations in Italy, and you'll be able to continue to buy your Apple products over there. If you do live over there, I'm curious to find out an actual consumer's opinion. If you've been into the Apple store, if you've made a purchase, are they really not doing a good job of informing you of the rights to your two-year warranty? I know this is an EU-wide issue. So I'd also be curious to hear from some of you in some of the other EU countries. Do you think that this kind of thing is going on, that Apple's kind of hiding it to actually try and sell you AppleCare? Or is it pretty well known that you get this standard two-year warranty and in most cases you might not need that extra coverage? I mean, it would still add an additional year and you also continue to get phone support for those other years. I think with the EU coverage that you're just going to be covered for the product and not maybe some of the other things that Apple provides. Also, I don't know how Apple would handle it if you came in and needed to do a service repair under the standard warranty that's governed by the European Union, if that varies or is different from what AppleCare offers you. Because I know one of the conveniences of AppleCare is that you just go into an Apple store, go into the Genius Bar, and they kind of take care of you right away. So I don't know if it would be a more laborious process where you actually had to ship the unit in and it was covered under that kind of EU-run warranty. So if you know a little bit about that, please share some information with us. Shoot us an email, mattcast@gmail.com. So the Google Nexus 7 tablet is hitting the street. It's starting to get some reviews, and it's generating a lot of really good buzz. So we've got a new 7-inch tablet that looks to be a very good competitor, probably more likely to the Kindle. And there's also rumors that a new Kindle tablet, new 7-inch Kindle tablet might be surfacing soon. So does that mean it's time for Apple to really get serious about putting out their own iPad mini, a 7-inch version of the iPad tablet? I have a feeling sometimes that some people feel if we just say it for long enough, wish it for long enough, eventually it will be true. But now the actual logic and timing behind the rumors seems to kind of make sense. It's becoming a little bit more plausible, at least in my mind. And the reason I say that is if you go back and you look at how the iPod gained market share and sort of took a market lead, and then how Apple continued to extend and maintain that lead, big part of that was sort of diversifying the form factor. So for the longest time, we just had the single iPod. Then they started branching out into other models to kind of keep themselves competitive and sort of cover all price points. So now we have some very viable tablets in the 7-inch size down at the lower end of the price points. It seems like it may be time for Apple to actually diversify the line and kind of cover all their bases. The Surface is also out there looming, Microsoft's 7-inch tablet. We don't know how much that is going to factor in because we don't have any firm specs in terms of pricing, in terms of a release date and something like that. But there's definitely a lot more competitors out there, and it might be time for Apple to jump into that market. iMore claims that Bloomberg has confirmed that there is a 7-inch iPad due possibly along the release of the new iPhone in the fall. Their sources seem to differ a little bit on the screen size. iMore is claiming that it's going to be a 2048 by 1536 resolution, about a 326 ppi pixel density, so that would be right in the Retina range. Bloomberg is saying it's a more modest 1024 by 768 display. Both sources seem to agree, though, on the release date and also on the pricing being in the range of $199 to $249 U.S., as a starting price. The units would likely feature smaller flash storage, possibly in the 8 to 16 gigabyte range, obviously supplemented with a service like iCloud. Later in the week, we heard that the Wall Street Journal was also piling on and kind of confirming that Apple is in pre-production or getting ready for production to ramp up on a new 7-inch tablet starting in December with a release in the October timeframe. So again, a lot of these rumors seeming very plausible. As far as what the screen resolution would be at that price point, I have to imagine that it's likely not going to be a Retina display on the 7-inch iPad. If Apple could pull that off at that price point, that would give them a huge lead and a lot of market share, I think, in that region. But even if they don't, just Apple putting out a iPad at the $199 to $249 price point would be a huge shakeup in that market. And a few months ago, I would have said it was odd for me to say that, or it would be odd for Apple to jump into that low-end market. But this kind of device could help Apple maintain their app marketplace lead and be another reason for developers to stay with the platform. As these other tablets come out, it does provide more incentive, especially if they gain a lot of market share, for app developers to start developing for those other devices. And I think Apple wants to maintain their lead mainly in the app marketplace, because I think it's the applications that really sell these devices and really take them further. The hardware is amazing. The price points can do a lot. But at the end of the day, it's what you can do with the tablet, and what you can do with it has everything to do with the software. So I think that's one big factor. I think another big factor is that there's a number of iPad owners even buying these 7-inch devices because of the price point, because it's a different form factor. So you see people who own an iPad picking up a Kindle Fire or even considering buying one of the new Google tablets as a media player, as a media device, something for reading ebooks. And Apple's going to want to make sure that it's their customers that are buying those devices and getting stuff on iBooks, getting stuff through iTunes, and not through some other marketplace. So timing at this point, it may be time for Apple to jump into that market. I think they've been considering it for a long, long time. I think they've had plans in place for a while. I think they've been testing out the form factor. And despite the fact that Steve Jobs denied vehemently that anybody wants this type of device, I think we are seeing some consumer demand, and I think Apple's going to want to be right there in the thick of things, selling tablets to those who want it. So it wouldn't surprise me in the fall if we do see Apple finally releasing that mythical 7-inch iPad. And so as I was saying, I think software and usage of tablets have a lot to do with what kinds of devices get sold and what kinds of things people want their tablets to do. And Gartner this week did an interesting survey asking smartphone, PC, and tablet owners to keep a diary of their daily activities to try and figure out how are people using these things. The study was conducted in the UK and Australia and actually returned some interesting results, although if you've owned an iPad for a while, you might just find that they're typical because they probably describe you. I know, at least for me, a lot of these revelations turned out to be not so surprising because it's like, yeah, that's exactly what I use my iPad for. So the main uses of tablets, according to Gartner, were checking email. 81% of the people said that they used it for that. Reading news was 96%. Checking the weather forecast, 63%, doing social networking, 62%, and gaming, 60%. So you can see how all of these uses, which were the most common ones, would work just as well probably on a 7-inch device as it would with a 10-inch iPad. Interestingly, 1 in 3 respondents said that they've actually read a book on the device, and that compared with only 13% of mobile PC users and just 7% of mobile phone users. So that does show that ebook usage among tablet users is higher, but I don't know that it necessarily indicates that it's really taking off. And again, maybe a smaller form factor device like a 7-inch tablet would lend itself better to reading ebooks and the whole ebook experience. Tablets tended to be mostly used in the home, and the highest percentage of usage was on weekday evenings. And also, they did some interesting things surrounding where tablets were actually used in the home. They found that 87% of the time they were used in the living room, 65% of the time in the bedroom, and 47% of the time in the kitchen. So again, that wasn't too surprising to me there. Those seemed like the likely locations. I'm surprised they didn't include the bathroom, but we probably don't want to know that statistic anyway. Tablets also tended to be more personal, and I think that's obvious. They're very personal devices. 45% of users said that they do not share their tablets. So that lends itself to actually having multiple tablets in the home, and that goes back to this theory that there's a number of people who might have an iPad, but then also might, for their family, purchase a smaller, more affordable tablet, say for kids or a spouse or something like that. And something that seems to support that theory as well is that men, I guess, tended to buy tablets more for themselves, while most women received tablets as a gift. That statistic to me seemed to support what I consider to be a stereotype, so I just don't want to go there. But there you have it. That's what the Gartner survey found. So some interesting results, I think, but not too surprising on a lot of levels, again, if you've owned an iPad for any period of time. The Lost Steve Jobs interview is now available for rent on iTunes, at least in the U.S. Robert Cringely's unedited interview tapes from the 1995 PBS documentary Triumph of the Nerds, which is a great documentary, by the way. If you haven't seen that, you can probably rent that. You might be able to find it on Netflix. But as part of that documentary, they did an interview with Steve Jobs. Only about 10 minutes of the footage actually made it into the PBS documentary. There was actually a full 70 minutes of tape. And so last year, that tape was found. It was cleaned up and released into theaters as a documentary That's what's now available on iTunes for rent. Again, unfortunately, it's only available in the U.S. The interviews were taped with Steve Jobs while he was at Next, and they cover a whole range of topics, including talking about the famous Blue Box that he built with Steve Wozniak. But mostly, it's a lot of conversation about Steve Jobs and sort of some of his philosophies and thoughts on the computer, the future of the computer industry, and just you really kind of can get into his head what he's thinking about as a businessman and how he envisioned the future of computers, at least in 1995. So I had a chance to see the documentary in the theater. I'm hoping to see it again on iTunes. Unfortunately, I was a bit disappointed that it is only available for rental. I wish it was available for purchase because it's something that I would like to have to kind of review because, again, there's just a lot of information, a lot of little gems in there, and you can gain a lot of insight into Steve Jobs when I think you sit down and watch him sort of talk for about 70 minutes about this stuff. So fascinating stuff. If you haven't seen it, you might want to rent it on iTunes. And then finally in the news for this week, I think there's little debate that we're expecting a new iPhone in the fall, the iPhone 5. Starting to get some details about what the possible specifications might be of the hardware. We've seen a lot of images and information related to the size of the screen. Most people think it's going to be a 4-inch screen, form factor a little bit taller. Even reports of some of the back plates surfacing and the front glass and stuff like that. But this week, Apple Insider cited a Digitimes report that says the processor in the next iPhone is going to be a quad core. Now, Digitimes has been kind of hit or miss on its Apple rumors, so anything coming out of there I kind of take with a grain of salt. The chip supposedly would be designed by Apple and made by Samsung based on their Exynos 4 architecture, which I believe is an ARM-based architecture. The new iPad's A5 processor uses Samsung's 45-nanometer low-power architecture and has a dual-core design with an integrated quad-core GPU, so this would be bumping up the CPU to quad-core. Doing that, I think, would help the iPhone stay competitive with some of the other phones that have been announced from companies like Samsung, HTC, LG, phones like the new Samsung Galaxy S3, those all have quad-core processors. So just as a bullet point to hit, it makes sense that Apple would want to do that. I think the one main factor, though, would be that Apple is meticulous about the battery life. So as long as they can get the performance out of it that they need, I think they'll go quad-core. But if they can do it in other ways, if they can get away like they did with the iPad 3 or the new iPad, having a quad-core GPU and great performance, I think you hardly notice the processor. So it's interesting because we're getting into the sort of the core wars. Is that what we want to call them? Where, remember how it used to be the megahertz myth where we would compete for megahertz numbers? I think now we're competing for cores. Whoever has the most cores wins. But I don't necessarily think that always translates to the best performance or the fastest system. I think there's all kinds of factors that go into play. And if Apple can make a dual core chip perform just as well as a quad core and save on battery life, I think that's the route they're going to go. They always tend to err toward the user experience. But if they just want to hit bullet points and they can hit their battery life targets with a quad core processor, I see no reason why they wouldn't do that. About the only other thing that I kind of have hesitation on this rumor about is that Samsung would be doing the manufacturing. We know that Samsung and Apple's relationship is somewhat strained, at least when it comes to the product side of things. They do seem to still be good partners on the component side. So they've done processors for Apple in the past. They could continue to do them again, although you would think Apple would want to break away and maybe go with another vendor. But we'll just have to see. We'll probably know by the fall. So I need to follow up on a couple stories that I covered over the last few episodes. I think about two episodes ago, I covered the story about an Apple store in Georgia reportedly refusing to sell an iPad to a woman who was speaking Farsi. It was alleged that they were doing that Apple was doing racial profiling of their customers and denying sales to certain regions and certain nationalities. And part of that was the fact that Apple has a policy of complying with some of the United States non-export policies to certain countries, and Iran being one of those countries. But I was trying to make the point in the piece when I covered it that these reports come out, they get really sensationalized by the media, and I think a lot of times they're just trying to grab that soundbite, they're trying to grab that emotion, and they don't dig down, they don't get to the facts, they don't look at all sides of the conversation. And I've always maintained that those of us in the media, and not only in the media, but those of us who are consuming these stories need to step back a little bit, get away from our emotions, and sort of get the bigger picture and take some time to drill down, especially if you hear these stories and you feel emotional about them and you feel connected to them, you have a right to yourself to kind of drill down and get at the facts. And so I was trying to make the point that we weren't in the store. We don't know the customers. We don't know the employees at the store. We don't know this customer. We don't know all of the details of the situation, and don't jump to conclusions. And I think during that segment, I said, I don't know if the employees at that store are racist. And I guess when I said that, some people, because I got some feedback, felt that I was implying that that was the case, that it could be that they're racist. And that was not my intention at all. So I want to clear that up. I was just saying, we don't know, so we didn't, so we should not assume. And so hopefully that's a lot clearer when I'm making that point. So again, my main point was, let's not jump to conclusions and let's not sort of assume things. And so since then, I've had a chance to get some more information, to do a little bit of digging, and I got some information actually from a direct source who knew a lot about the incident, and they claimed that the person who was making the purchase in the Apple store did say to this employee that they intended to take the product back to Iran or ship the product to Iran. Now, the curious thing in the information that I got was he specifically said he, and it was actually in the story a young woman who was trying to purchase the iPad, Shahir Sabet. And so I thought about that a little bit. And, you know, if it is the case that they said, yes, we're going to ship this to Iran, then under Apple's policy and their compliance with U.S. law to not ship products to Iran, they would be making the right choice. But obviously, it's not that clear, because there was a statement issued by a lawyer for Sabet, and he wanted to clear up some things that were being reported in the media, what he called misreportings in the media. And he made some statements. He said that Sabet was at the Apple store to purchase an iPad, but it was for her cousin, and that was out in the story. But some of the reports were saying the cousin lived in Iran, and that's not the case. This cousin is in North Carolina. So it would have been perfectly fine for Apple to sell her the iPad. Same time, she had relatives with her from Houston, and one of those relatives was an uncle, and it was the uncle that she was speaking Farsi to, and that was what sort of ignited this incident, had the employee come over and ask what language she was speaking, and that's how they found out that she was from Iran. And so I guess according to the lawyer's statement, what they were saying was that Sabet was attempting to purchase the iPad when her uncle then asked some questions about an iPhone that he was considering purchasing for his daughter, who was in Tehran in Iran. And so Sabet translated at that point, and that's when the employee came over and asked about the language and then denied the sale of the iPad to Sabet. The EFF also came out with some additional information, and they pointed out the fact that U.S. companies have to be extremely cautious about any situation where they might even think they're selling a product to an embargoed country. And the reason is that the U.S., under these embargoes and under the stated policies, tell companies that they can't sell to these countries. And if they knowingly do that, the fines and penalties can be extreme, up to $1 million fine, and the person involved could get up to 20 years in prison. So if you're an Apple employee, that's pretty scary stuff, right? You're not going to want to accidentally do this. So once you have all the facts, you can kind of see how this whole mess could have come about and could have been due to a huge and very unfortunate misunderstanding and miscommunication between the two parties. So looking at it that way, what really should have happened is Sabet should have been allowed to purchase the iPad for a cousin who lives in the U.S. That's perfectly fine. The uncle should have been told that he couldn't get the iPhone because we can't sell something knowing that it's being shipped to Iran. The employee at the store who reportedly came over and said the reason he couldn't sell the iPad to Sabet was that the two countries had bad relations. He could have had better training, been told maybe by his managers or by Apple, a more official statement that he could give that would explain the situation a little bit better, and maybe with a little bit more sensitivity. But, of course, all of this information doesn't come out until time has passed and maybe people have calmed down and you get to look at the situation from a number of different angles. And so what immediately happens is this sensationalism, this emotional outburst and stuff like that, and then everybody's just angry and upset. So my point still stands with this story and with all stories that we get coming in, that very often they're much more complex. They go much deeper than the 2-minute news clip or the 250-word blog post that we're reading. And so somewhat related to this, I got another bit of feedback from a listener, a MacCast listener, Carlos. He's from Brazil, and he was told that he couldn't purchase an iPad for a friend in Brazil when he went to purchase it from an Apple store also in Atlanta, a different Apple store, but this one at the Perimeter Mall. In his case, everything was fine until he mentioned that he was buying the iPad for a friend in Brazil. And then he was told that he couldn't be sold the device because he intended to resell it in the country. And I guess Apple has a policy against reselling devices or selling to someone who they might feel are reselling the device. Although I've never heard that stated before, and I didn't know that was the case. I have kind of heard some reports of different people being denied sales at the Apple store. It's specifically way back when the iPhone was really popular and Apple wasn't selling the iPhone into as many countries. You had instances where people were coming over and paying cash for 5, 6, 7 iPhones at a time. And in those instances, I think it would be safe to assume that these people are probably going back and reselling it. But at the same time, I don't think you can assume that. You don't know the specific situations. And even if you ask, I don't know that it's an Apple employee's place to have to kind of enforce those policies. I guess we could debate on that a little bit. But in Carlos's case, I think it was kind of ridiculous because he was just buying one iPad. And if he was just going to give it to a friend in Brazil, I don't consider that really reselling. And I think Carlos felt the same way, which is why he emailed me. And so he ended up having to leave the Apple store and just walk kind of across the street to a Best Buy and buy it, and you know, problem solved. But it still left him with a bad experience at the Apple store. And I think that is probably my biggest problem with both these stories, is that even if these policies exist, and of course the non-export policy one does, we've confirmed that, Apple is making their employees sort of have to act on these policies, and in many cases, in a way that could be construed in a discriminatory fashion. It does give the impression, potentially, and especially depending upon how it handled, that they're doing this kind of profiling and discrimination. And that just makes for a potentially bad situation on a lot of levels. I don't think employees need to, nor should they have to be put in a position where they have to act like enforcement agents. I think it's awkward for the employees. I think it's insulting potentially to the customers, and it can create a very bad customer experience, as we've seen with these latest examples. And I don't think that's a position or a place that Apple wants to take the company, or an image that they want to portray. So I think it's really unfortunate. I wish, you know, this information could come out right when it happens, but unfortunately it takes time and most people are going to miss all of the facts and details surrounding this. So I wanted to come back and touch back on that stuff. If you have more to add to this conversation, please feel free to send me some additional feedback to chime in. But I hope that kind of clarifies some things and just gives you a little more insight into sort of how I'm feeling about it. Another big story that happened that I covered on the last MacCast was the podcast app, Apple releasing their official podcast app for iOS. I gave you some of my thoughts and opinions about the new application and even offered up a few little tricks. But I also got some feedback from Arne, who had this to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Arne from Germany. I've got two comments on your episode on the new podcast app from Apple. The first one is There's missing a setting there which prevents the streaming via 3G network. As I'm on a tight data plan, after 300 megabytes, I got capped. And when I watch a video podcast, that one was probably downloaded, it just jumps to the next one, and that was not downloaded. And then, it streams, and I didn't notice. And then I got that notifier from my carrier that I'm over my limit. That was great. So that would be really nice to have. And another comment is on, I listen to your podcast in my car, so I'm using an iPod Touch, and I'm synchronizing that with my Mac Mini at home, so over Wi-Fi, iTunes Sync, so that's all fine. But all these systems in the cars, they just use the music from the iPod app. So they probably wouldn't pick up the podcast stuff. So if that would all be moved out of the music app, that would be really bad, because then I couldn't just do the same thing listening to the podcast here in the car. So that would be really bad. Okay, so that was what two comments from my side. Thanks for your show, and bye.
Hey, thanks, Aaron. I think those are great comments, and certainly something. You're not the only one who pointed those two out, I guess, is what I should say. I got some emails from a few people who were saying exactly the same thing, specifically related to being able to turn off 3G streaming in the podcast app itself. Of course, you can go into the main settings and turn off 3G data, but then your 3G is not working at all. So really what you want to do is selectively say, hey, look, in the podcast app, let's not download anything over 3G. Let's do Wi-Fi only. So hopefully they'll be adding that setting at some point in the future. And I think also there are a lot of concerns. As you mentioned, most of these in-car systems that integrate and allow you to control your music tie into the music app right now, and they're not going to tie directly into that podcast app. So if Apple does eventually move all that stuff out to be completely separate, we could have a problem. Luckily, at least at the moment, it seems to live in both places, although we don't know how long that's going to continue. I'll add to that a little bit, because I got some feedback from some other people that, older iPod Touches, like first generation iPod Touches, all that stuff still is in the music app, and I guess they can't run the new podcast application. So if Apple does happen to eventually remove that from the music app, that could be a problem for those customers. Also, if Apple at some point decides, like they're doing with notes and reminders and stuff like that, to push podcasts into their own application on the Mac desktop, how does that work for syncing up with older devices, and specifically older like iPod Classics and iPod Nanos and things like that? So there's a lot of unanswered questions surrounding the podcast app and Apple's future plans for podcasts within iTunes or outside of iTunes or however that might work. And I think only time's going to tell, but I have to imagine that the people over at Apple are well aware of some of these issues and are thinking about them, or at least I hope they are, and we'll have them all resolved at some point, and at least when Apple's ready to move on. And I hopefully they're not going to pull the situation where they kind of leave a bunch of users in the dust and say, look, we're moving to this, and all of that legacy stuff is out the window, although they have done that. So I wouldn't put it past them, but I have a feeling that's not going to happen anytime really soon. So I think we're going to have a little while to transition, and we'll be in this transition period for a while. Another thing I want to kind of follow up on related to the podcast is on the last show, I covered a trick where you can subscribe directly to podcasts in the podcast app if you plug the feed into the search box. If you just take a raw XML feed or an RSS feed for a podcast and paste that URL into the search box in the podcast app, it'll pop up and ask you if you want to subscribe to it. And related to that, I covered a tip where you can actually subscribe to, say, a protected feed like the MacCast Member Show by adding your username and password into the URL that you paste in there. And so if you want to hear that tip in full, you can go back and listen to that prior episode. But along with that, I mentioned a few caveats about security that you might want to consider. Because you're putting your username and password into the URL, you want to make sure that that's not being sent in the clear. So I said, You want to make sure you're subscribing to a protected podcast or a protected feed that supports SSL in the URL, so using HTTPS. And you also want to make sure that you don't use any of the sharing options that are built into the podcast app, because when you do that, it sends an email or it sends a text with the full URL to the podcast. And if you've entered your username and password in there, that's going to be exposed to the person receiving your shared email. And one listener emailed me with a follow-up and some concerns that even with SSL, even using HTTPS, that the URL would still need to resolve, and so felt possibly it would be sent unencrypted and there might be a risk there. Now, I'm not an expert on this stuff, so if I get something wrong and you know about it, please correct me, send me an email. But I was concerned as well after reading this message and concerned that maybe I gave some false information, and I looked into it further, and from what I can tell and my understanding of it, it has to do with how the TCP connection works and the HTTP protocol work. And it seems that with SSL, at first, a TCP connection is established, an encrypted, protected TCP connection is made between the client and the server, and that happens before the HTTP request is sent. So that GET request, the URL string, and everything should be passed over that encrypted TCP connection. So I think you're okay there. Now, that said, there are a couple other potential points that I don't think I brought up in that episode, potential points of exposure that I probably should make you aware of, and then you at least can make an informed decision on whether or not you want to use the podcast app to connect to your protected feeds. So while the URL, as it's being sent across the TCP connection, is going to be encrypted, I found out that the URL could be stored in a couple of locations, possibly in an unencrypted form. Of course, in the iOS app itself, it's probably stored in the preferences somewhere. So someone with physical access to your device, your iPhone or your iPod, could potentially get at that login information. I mean, even if they just opened up the app and hit the share button, that stuff would be exposed. So you need to be aware of that. I think that's not that high of a risk, because if you've lost physical control of your device, you've got bigger problems on your hand. And you should be using a lock code on your device, which will encrypt the data on the latest generations of iPhones and iPods and stuff like that. So you should be fairly well protected there. The other thing is that on the server side, when you're connecting to a web server, the place that has the protected RSS feed, there is an SSL access log. So there's a log file, and since you're sending the information in the URL string in the GET request, it's possible that that's actually being logged in those log files. So if that server was physically hacked and someone gained access to those log files, they potentially could get at that URL string, and that would have your login credentials in it. All that said, if you're doing best practices when it comes to safe password procedures and you're using separate logins for everything like you should be, then your exposure should be relatively minimized. I mean, the worst thing that would happen in that case is an attacker could have access to the login and password for your protected podcast feed, which means they could listen to the podcast, but I would have a feeling that's more of an issue for the podcaster. Someone like me, who now has unauthorized access to the podcast feed from someone who maybe hasn't paid for it. So not probably a potential problem for the end user. I think it's relatively benign and safe. Again, if you're using safe password practices, which you should be. So just wanted to make you aware of those issues. And thank you, Arn, for your feedback on the podcast app. One of the big reasons I am an Apple fan, I think, and why I've been an Apple customer for so long is the fact that, one, the products are just incredibly well made, incredibly well designed. I don't think anybody's really going to argue that. But a big part of it, too, has to do with not only the community, but just the support that Apple gives you as an Apple customer and how they stand behind their products. If there is a problem, especially when you're under Apple Care, they really do take care of you. I've had a number of machines that have been replaced after having issues. I have always had good luck with customer service. And I know we talk about some of the times when customer service isn't so great, and I like having those conversations, but my favorite conversations are the ones where I hear that somebody got really good support from Apple. And I just love sharing those. And it happened this week that I got that type of comment from Brian.
Hi, Adam. Before I tell my story, I would just like to say congratulations on 400 podcasts. It's a hell of a milestone. I've been listening to you for years now, and just keep up the good work. I really love your podcast. Quick story. My friend and I both bought the new Retina MacBook Pros. I got mine in already. I love it. I can't stop using it. I'm losing sleep. I mean, I just stare at my display. I just drool. My friend is due to get hers in a couple days. But when she ordered her computer a couple weeks back, she was on the fence about getting a display. And as you know, if you purchase a display when you buy your computer in the AppleCare, they put it under the AppleCare, so they're both covered. But she was on the fence whether to get a refurbished model or a new one. Wasn't really, you know, sure. So she called up AppleCare and asked if she could decide what she wanted to do, place the order with the computer. But then if she wants a display, could she call up and, you know, put it under AppleCare? And they said, sure. They'll make a note on her order. And when she calls back up, she can order it and they're going to put it under AppleCare. So she was fine with that. So a couple days went by. She finally decided to get the refurbished model, called up. And they said there may be an issue and she may have to purchase AppleCare separately. She explained that she spoke to the person the first time who said that they would make a note. And I guess this person didn't see any note. So she was on the phone with Apple support for like 25, 30 minutes. And I guess someone from Apple contacted AppleCare and spoke to somebody. And I believe she said there was someone high up, you know, like the director or something. I don't know if they were just making that up. But they said, well, it won't be possible because there would be two distinct orders, two separate orders, and she would have to purchase AppleCare separately. So I'm listening to this, and I'm like, you know, it sucks, number one, but let's see if I can just, you know, help in some small way. So I'm like, well, let me email Tim Cook. In the back of my mind, thinking, you know, probably if he does get it, he may, you know, get it in 2 months or may not respond, or, you know, probably get to millions of messages a day. So I emailed Tim Cook, explained the situation, and said, you know, if there's anything, we're longtime Apple fans, loyal customers, if there's anything you can do, you know, I know you got a busy schedule. So I sent it, you know, pretty much forgot about it as soon as I sent it. Next day, I get a call, someone from Apple. They said, is this Brian? I'm like, yes. He's like, I'm so-and-so from Apple. You emailed Tim Cook with a problem. And the guy explained, I mean, I don't know how he got my phone number. I didn't give my phone number. So Apple, I mean, they know all. So they looked at my account or something, but they got my contact information, probably through my email address. And he said, you know, certainly, this display will be put on AppleCare. He gave me his direct number, his email. He gave me a case number. You know, he said, have her email me directly. I want to stay in the loop. When she gets the computer in, have her call me when the display comes in. I guess they want the serial number. And he said, we'll definitely put it on AppleCare. And I was just blown away because, I mean, talk about support. You know, I went right to the top. And less than a day, less than 24 hours later, basically it was resolved. So, I mean, I don't know any other company on the face of the earth that things work that quickly for such a company that's so big. You know, I can't even fathom emailing a CEO, you know, of Nike or you know, of Coca-Cola and having, you know, less than a day getting a call back. So I thought that was pretty special. That was just everything I believe in Apple in terms of their support and their willingness to keep their customers happy. Everything was so clarified in my eyes that this is a great company that really cares. So if you have any problems, don't hesitate to contact Tim Cook because he may just help you out. Okay, thanks, Adam, and good luck with the next 400. Have a good day.
Hey, Brian, I hope you're getting some sleep now. Maybe you've been able to pry yourself away from that gorgeous new display. I'm kind of jealous to a certain degree. And thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm glad that your friend got some resolution on her issue. I agree. It's totally amazing. And the more and more we hear about these stories, it's becoming a pretty common scenario. I think it's probably fairly obvious that there's a small staff of Apple employees that monitor, filter, and probably respond to a lot of the email that comes in for Tim Cook. And I think that's really great. My only concern at this point now is that it's becoming a little bit of a trend to either email, or it was a trend to email Steve Jobs, and now it's sort of becoming this trend to email Tim Cook. I'll even throw out his email address. It's tcook@apple.com if you want to email him. And I do that at risk of this concern that I have, which is that as the practice becomes more and more common, it will become abused by a number of people as sort of the default route that they go for taking support. And I'm not implying that's what you did in this case, Brian. I think you did the right thing. You know, you were not happy with the support you were getting, and that's when you need to escalate it up a little bit. And it also sounds like you escalated it up through the default support channels as much as you could before you fell back to emailing Tim Cook. And I think that's the proper way to handle this. My concern is that it becomes the first channel that a lot of people start to take, and then the signal-to-noise ratio becomes so great that even with a staff of people behind the email address, it becomes almost impossible to manage. So I love these stories, and I love the fact that customers are getting excellent, even phenomenal support from Apple, but I think you can get that from the default support channels. And so I encourage people to try there first. You know, go ahead and call AppleCare. If you're not getting the resolution you want from the first tier person, like Brian mentioned they did, escalate it up. Ask to talk to a manager or someone higher up who maybe can give you a little bit better satisfaction. And then if that doesn't work, then you might try the next step of sending an email to the office of Tim Cook. The Genius Bar is also an amazing resource to have. It's something that a lot of us have access to. If you're in a region where you can get into an Apple store reasonably, you might consider doing that. Even if you tried with AppleCare support on the phone, you might make an appointment at a Genius Bar. And don't worry if you're under AppleCare or not. Go ahead and make the appointment. Go in and talk to them. And I think you'll be surprised at how willing they are to help you and help out and even do so without an AppleCare contract under your belt or behind your system. At the very worst, they're going to tell you how much it's going to cost to fix your system, but you'd be surprised how many times they just resolve the issue right there in store. So Apple has great, phenomenal customer service. I think they're well known for it, and you're right to take advantage of it in whatever method that you can. And I guess staying somewhat on the topic of the new MacBook Pros and these new Retina MacBook Pros, I got an email this week from Peter. He just got one of the new 15-inch non-Retina MacBook Pros and was interested in maxing out the RAM. I think that's one of the best upgrades you can do. It's RAM's still very affordable, even if you buy it from Apple, but you can get it through a third party. And that is sort of what triggered Peter's question about the RAM, because very often Apple states on its website and its tech specs for its model that certain machines max out at a certain level of RAM. So in the case of the 15-inch MacBook Pro, I think Apple's site states that it'll take up to 8 gigabytes. But when Peter was doing his research on upgrading the RAM, he noticed several sites mentioning that you can actually install 16 gigabytes of RAM. So rather than 2 4-gigabyte sticks, it has 2 slots, you can actually put in 2 8-gigabyte sticks, but Apple does not list that in the technical specifications. Also on Apple's website, they sell that 8-gigabyte upgrade in the build-to-order options for about $100. The current rate, if you go through a third party, say like Crucial.com, is around $54 US. So Apple's not gouging. It used to be Apple was double, triple, even sometimes quadruple the memory price. They're reasonably pricing their upgrades, but they're still a little bit more expensive, so you might want to consider going through a third party. Now, I'm not really sure why Apple often understates the maximum amount of RAM that you can put in a system, but it may have something to do, I'm guessing, with just how they tested the systems, or maybe what kind of stock they have on for their build-to-order options. Sometimes there's also a physical design limitation in the model. Classic case of this is back on some of the 2007 and 2008 MacBook Pros. Apple listed that they would max out at 4 gigabytes of RAM, so 2 2-gigabyte models or modules in their slots. But the architecture itself would actually allow for up to 6 gigabytes of RAM to be recognized in the system. But the way you would have to get there is you'd have to put in two 4-gigabyte sticks, so you would have 8 gigabytes, but the motherboard sort of limited it so you could only use 6 gigs. So in that case, I think it was a case of Apple not wanting to have you have missing RAM. So by saying it maxes out at 4 gigs, then you're getting all of the RAM that Apple says will run in the system. So why they do that, I don't know. It's a little bit of a mystery, but it is something that they do. The other thing related to it is I have heard sometimes that if you go in and you max out the RAM beyond the stated specification that Apple has on their website, sometimes they won't service the unit until you bring it back into what they consider to be the official specification or factory spec. So if you go in with your MacBook Pro and you max it out at 16 gigabytes and then you suddenly have some issues, you need to take it in under AppleCare, they may ask you to put the original RAM back in. I want to be clear that you can max out the RAM and you can swap out the RAM. It's not going to void your warranty because sometimes people think that'll be the case. But you just might be asked to restore it back to a factory specification or a supported specification before they'll actually work on it. And that may go back to why they rate these things. Maybe they've tested it and found that beyond a certain RAM level, the reliability isn't within the specification that Apple feels comfortable in certifying. I really don't know. If you happen to know, if you've worked at an Apple store, you have some inside information on this, I'd love to know the specific reason. But don't be afraid of maxing out the RAM, even if it's beyond Apple's specification. And if you want to know what your machine will actually max out at versus what Apple specifies, a great way to do that is to use the application Mac Tracker. Absolutely love this application. It's donationware. If you use it, please donate to the developer because I want him to continue to make the software for a really long time. But this has information on every Mac model out there. If you launch the application, find your specific model and go into the memory and graphics section. They will list the Apple amount of RAM and the actual amount of maximum memory under the maximum memory listing, so you can see what's supported. And then I buy most of my RAM either from Crucial.com or OWC. OWC is at MacSales.com. I really like using Crucial because they have their little memory configuration tool that really makes it easy to see the maximum amount of RAM that's supported in your model. And typically when you plug in your information, they will offer up the maximum amount your system can take as their recommended kit, but you can also expand that out and see the different memory kit modules that they sell for your particular model. So, Peter, good luck with the new MacBook Pro, and for sure, just max it out, throw 16 in there, and I think you'll be good to go. This next thing that I have to talk to you about is one of those I get actually asked about a lot, and I haven't covered it on the show because, frankly, it's one thing about OS X Lion that's never really bothered me, but I know a lot of people truly hate the new look of the address book and of iCal. Apple's been changing the look actually of a number of their applications to make things look more virtually like the physical versions of the things that they're supposed to represent. So in the case of iCal, they sort of added this desktop calendar blotter style look to it where you would, you know, tear the sheets off. It's even got the little torn paper up there at the top, and some people absolutely hate it. It's got the little stitched leather look. I think the general term that's being applied to this kind of UI is skeuomorphism, I think people refer to it as. It's a sort of realistic representation digitally of the physical object. And it's becoming more and more common, not just even in Apple's UIs, but we've seen it in other things. I think Circus Ponies, which they're a sponsor of the show, their product notebook is a great example of it, of this, and they've been using that model and that sort of design since the very beginning. So definitely not new, but becoming more and more commonplace, and Apple's doing it a lot more in their software, and some people absolutely hate it. And so if you do absolutely hate it, there is a bit of a hack that you can do, and you can get rid of that style. And it's a mild hack. It's nothing really serious, But I'm going to say the general caveats apply. If you're going to go through this technique, and this is a little bit why I've been hesitant to share it, but I tried it out and I had no issues with it. So I'm going to let you know how to do it because I know a lot of you really, really hate it. But the caveats are back up first, make a copy of the application before you apply the hack, just in case you need to restore it. And be aware that with iCal, you will have to remove the hacked copy from the command line. You can't just, you can make a backup of iCal, store it someplace else, make a copy of the application. But if you try and just throw the old copy back over your hacked copy, it's going to give you a warning message. So you're going to have to go into the command line to kind of clear things out and reset stuff. Not that difficult again, but if you're uncomfortable with the command line, you might want to hold back a little bit. So I actually found two solutions. There are others, I'm sure. Both are basically installers that you launch, and they go into the application packages themselves, and they replace the image sources that create that calendar effect, that skeuomorphic effect. So they don't actually alter any of the application data. So again, they're relatively safe, a little bit hacky, but one is called, one is from MacNix, and they have an installer. They also have some instructions on how to back up and restore your files. And they also have a hack that will work on the address book. So if you hate that, you can get their hack too. I'll have a link to both of these hacks in the show notes at maccast.com. So MacNix is one of them. The other one is an application that actually allows you to kind of tweak a lot more things. It's called Lion Tweaks. And I know a number of people that use this application to do various things on their Mac. It does a lot of those terminal hacks that we've covered on the MacCast in the past. But specifically, they have an option to change the iCal leather look to aluminum. And I think they also have the one for the address book as well. And this is probably the easiest one to apply. You just launch the application, you go in, you turn it on. And I think in the case of this one, it actually can restore the application without having to go back to your backup. So you might want to try this one first. You basically download the application, you launch it, and it runs a separate installer. And then it swaps out the graphics assets, and you end up with just the standard OS silver, gray brushed metal kind of look in your iCal and in your address book if you want that. So you can try these out and get rid of that look. I tried them both. They both worked fine for me. About the only weird thing was with the calendar, with iCal, it still had the sort of light brown text for some of the buttons rather than black. So that looked a little bit odd, a little bit weird, and I really didn't like it. So I just went back to the original leather look that came in Lion, because that, frankly, really doesn't bother me. But if it really bothers you, you really absolutely hate it, here's a couple different ways that you can get the old look back. I guess a lot of people are getting that new Retina MacBook Pro. That is a sweet system, and a lot of you seem to be picking that up. Because the last story I have for you today came from an email I received from Daniel. He's getting a new Retina MacBook Pro, and he's decided that he wants to keep his old Mac at work and then keep his new Retina MacBook Pro at home. But what he wanted to do was be able to share an operating system between them, the same OS on both of them, have all his applications, all his system preferences, all that sort of stuff. And so his idea was to get an external USB 3.0 drive and then install macOS 10 onto that and then use that as the primary boot drive on both systems. So just take the drive back and forth between both systems, boot off of it, and then he always has his home folder and all his applications and all his stuff on either system. It doesn't matter which hardware he's on, he's taking it back and forth. And, you know, this sounds like a great idea, but he emailed me saying, you know, I ran into some issues and I had some questions. And so he was wondering if we could help him out with that. And, you know, Daniel, I think we can. I've only ever operated off of an external bootable volume in kind of an emergency capacity. So if I've had an internal hard drive that failed, I have a super duper clone backup that I can use. I can immediately boot off of that and continue working until I have time to come back and address the issue, replace the drive, and sort of swap it out and stuff like that. And so I've only ever worked in that capacity for a few days. I can tell you, in doing that, it works great. It works really, really well. I've never had an issue, and I've been able to do it just fine. Now, your specific scenario, I've never tried. I have no reason to believe it wouldn't work. And as a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it will. If any of you out there, though, have been doing that, running your Mac off of an external volume and running it across multiple Macs, I'd love to hear some feedback on how that works on a daily basis, any issues that you've run into, any problems, and I'm sure Daniel would appreciate if you'd share those with him as well. So send them along to me, and I'll try and share them on a future episode. But the first issue that Daniel actually ran into that he emailed me about was in testing the setup. He bought a USB 3 external drive and installed the operating system on it, and then tried to hook it up to his brother's new MacBook Air, one of the brand new models that supports USB 3. And he found that in that case, the drive would not boot the system. And it would work from another Mac, but it just wouldn't work from that one. So he was wondering if there was an issue with booting from a USB 3 drive on the new systems. And I would guess that maybe that's the case. Maybe Apple needs to work on some of the firmware to make USB 3 drives bootable on the Mac. But I would think they would have handled that already. And so I did a little research on this, and I found a forum post over on the Carbon Copy Cloner forums. And actually, the developer of that software, Mike Bombick, replied to somebody asking about some issues booting from a USB 3 drive. And he said that he's had a number of reports that there's kind of inconsistencies in booting Macs from USB 3 drives, although in this case, it was mostly older Macs with USB 2 ports built into them. And his theory was that there could be a firmware issue that maybe Apple needs to update some things on the software side. It could also be the brand of drive. I don't know. You might try a different brand and see if that boots. But technically, you shouldn't have any problems booting a Mac from a USB 2 or USB 3 drive. I'm not really sure why it's not working in your case, Daniel. So hopefully you can get that figured out. Maybe some people in the community will have some ideas on that. But the other thing that Daniel wanted to know was if it's possible to encrypt the bootable external drive for security purposes. So in case it gets lost or stolen in transit, can it be encrypted and can it be protected? And I thought this one might be a little bit more tricky, but I did find a procedure, someone who's actually done it. He created an external encrypted volume using Disk Utility. So he got the new external volume, formatted it with Disk Utility and its encryption tools, and then used SuperDuper to clone his internal drive and then set the whole thing up in System Preferences as his boot drive. I'll have a link to his blog post that has all the specific details on how he set it up in the show notes at maccast.com. But in his case, he worked with Dave over at Shirt Pocket, the makers of Super Duper, on the procedure, and posted about it on his blog and has all of the details. So you obviously can do it. You can make it work. It might be a little bit of setup work, but there's one procedure that I can point you to. The other thing, though, is I would think that you should also be able to just, if you get the bootable external volume working, you should be able to go in the System Preferences and I would imagine turn on File Vault 2, which should encrypt the entire boot volume in your home folder and stuff like that. So that might be another route you can go to get an encrypted external volume that you can boot from. Another thing Daniel had asked about was, would there be any issues in taking that single external boot volume between the two Macs? And there my initial thought was, well, there's differences in the hardware and potentially extreme differences in the hardware. I didn't know if maybe there might be possibly some firmware issues or driver issues with the default hardware. So I posted on the MacCast forums, and John Foster, who helps out a lot over there, really smart guy. He does or did the MacBreak Tech podcast, the No Mac podcast, really has been around in the industry for a long time and really knows his stuff. He pointed out that OS X is a unidriver system, meaning that when you install it on a Mac, it doesn't do an install based on the specific hardware. So you should have no problems if you're installing from a retail copy of Mac OS X, doing that, running it on an external volume and moving it between the two different Macs. At least from a pure, you know, can I boot it, will it run sort of standpoint. Now, the follow-up question to all this was, and Daniel asked, was about performance. You know, am I going to see a performance issue running off an external volume? And here, both John and I agree that booting off of an external, especially a USB device, and especially if it's connected under USB 2, is going to be slow. It's going to be a lot slower in performance than booting off of the internal drive, especially on something like a Retina MacBook Pro with the solid state. It's going to be screaming fast if you use the internal booting. If you're booting off a USB drive, it's going to be noticeably slower, especially in launching applications and performing operations and stuff like that. Now, an alternative could be that you could use a FireWire 800 or even better yet, an eSATA drive or even better yet, a Thunderbolt drive, but that is going to get expensive. You might not have Thunderbolt on both systems. You definitely don't have eSATA connectors out of the box on multiple systems, and you may or may not have FireWire on both systems. So that would just make things a little bit tricky. So really, at that point, your best bet might just be to use the MacBook Pro exclusively as your main system and just carry it between home and work. So Daniel, I'm not really sure why you want to have one system at work and one system at home. Maybe it's this type of situation where your office doesn't technically let you bring your own system to work. I'm not really sure. But for fastest performance, you're definitely not going to get it by booting off of an external volume. But if that doesn't matter to you, then it seems like technically it should be a viable solution. And I guess the last question that he had was about running boot camp on the external volume, which isn't an option from what I remember, what I know about boot camp. I don't think you can run it off of an externally booted drive. It has to be on the internal drive and that special partition that the installer creates on that internal drive. So if you do need to run Windows, probably your best bet there is to use some sort of virtualization application, something like Parallels or VMware Fusion. Now, I know in Daniel's case, he was hoping to use it for gaming, so performance might not work using Parallels or VMware Fusion, so that might not be an option. So if anybody knows if there is a way to sort of run boot camp off of an external drive, maybe let us know how that works. And, you know, the other option, I guess, would be to still install Mac OS X and boot camp on the internal drive and then just boot into that when you need to, although it might be a little bit painful to have to eat up. I think boot camp requires about 30 gigs of space. Might be a little bit painful to eat that up on the limited flash storage that you might have on that new Retina MacBook Pro. So there's some thoughts and ideas for you. Hopefully some people in the community will have some additional thoughts and ideas. And with that, I think it's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, if you need to get cash for an old iOS device or Mac, you should check them out. Head over to gazelle.com and get your offer today. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, you can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, PDF Pen for iPad, and Text Expander Touch. Awesome applications. They make great stuff. You can get free trials of their Mac software as well as more information and details on their products over at smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. I love answering your questions. If you have a comment, a question, what have you, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast website at maccast.com. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about in this episode or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out those forums. Great guys like, you know, John over there answering questions every day. So if you have a technical question, if you have a comment, if you just want to have a conversation with some really smart Mac people, it's a great place to do it, and it's free to sign up. Forum.maccast.com is the address. Also, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page, that's at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.